But they, too, were to see more of the first foreign woman who walked through their beautiful country, and while their acts were to be quite commonplace and not in the least surprising, mine will probably live long in the memory of those who witnessed them. Maybe a legend will arise out of it all, and who knows if, in the future, a learned student of folklore will not offer some interesting commentary on the story, being far from suspecting the truth of it. At dusk that very evening, weary after a long tramp and having definitely abandoned the hope of joining the travelers, at least that same night, we were following the rising course of the Tongyuka River which, hidden by the thick foliage, roared far beneath our narrow trail. I was walking ahead, looking for a camping place, when I saw seven men coming toward me. A sudden foreboding seized me. I did not expect any good from this meeting. Nevertheless, as sang-froid is the best of weapons, and as many years' experience of adventurous life had accustomed me to situations of this kind, I continued to walk calmly, with the indifferent air of a tired woman pilgrim. One of the band stood in the middle of the narrow track and asked me where I was coming from and where I was going to. I muttered the names of some holy places, and passed between him and the bushes. He did not attempt to stop me. I was already rejoicing inwardly at the thought that this time, once more, nothing would happen. When looking back, I saw that my son had stopped and was leaning against a rock and speaking with the men. However, the talk seemed friendly and the voices did not rise above the normal pitch. But I could not hear what was said. Then I noticed that one of the tall fellows was taking something from the handkerchief of the lama. I knew that he had a few coins in it. But I did not realize what was happening, and I thought that the papas were selling us something. I only understood the truth when Yongdan shouted to me, "They have taken my 2 rupees. The amount was not worth a thought, but I saw that some of the robbers had laid their hands on the load he carried on his back and were about to open it. The situation was growing serious. Fighting was out of the question. Had I shot one of the men, the others would have immediately stabbed my defenseless companion with the long swords they carried thrust in their belts. On the other hand, to let them examine the contents of our bags would be dangerous. In them were a few foreign objects, unfamiliar to these savages, that would have appeared strange in the possession of ragged pilgrims and would have awakened suspicion as to our identity. And once on the track, the robbers might perhaps search us and discover the gold hidden under our clothes. What would follow? They might kill us on the spot, or take us before one of their chiefs, who would inform the nearest Lhasa government official if I confessed to be a foreigner in disguise, or would treat us as thieves if I persisted in my incognito. In a word, he would appropriate our gold and beat us both mercilessly. Most of all, I feared being recognized, and thus prevented from proceeding. At any rate, the robbers must be left with the quickly forgotten impression that they had but met a poor lama pilgrim with his aged and beggar mother. In much less time than I have taken to write it, all these thoughts passed through my mind. I found the plot of the drama to be played on that rustic stage and I began my part, screaming at the top of my voice, howling in utter despair. With tears rolling on my cheeks, I lamented the loss of the 2 rupees, the only money we had got. What was to become of us? How would we feed ourselves during the long trip to Lhasa? And these 2 rupees were sacred money indeed, the offering of a pious householder whose father had died and for whom my son, the Lama, had performed the funeral rites, dispatching him to the land of bliss, the Western Paradise. Now these miscreants had dared to steal it. But revenge would come. Here I ceased to weep and rose to imprecation. The task was not very difficult. Well acquainted as I am with the Vuriaus deities of the Tibetan pantheon, I called upon the most dreaded ones, uttering their most terrible names and titles. There was Paldan Dorji Lamo, who rides a wild horse on a saddle made of a bloody human skin. There were the angry ones who devour the flesh of men and feast on the fresh brains served in their skulls, and the giant frightful ones, companions of the King of Death, crowned with bones and dancing on corpses. I conjured them all and implored them to avenge us. Verily I was the initiated and ordained wife of a black Nagspa. His tutelar demons would not fail to avenge the harm done to his innocent son, who had taken to the pure saintly path of the Geelong. I am a tiny woman with nothing dramatic in my appearance, but at that moment I felt myself rising to the height of a powerful tragedian. The forest had become darker and a light breeze had arisen which caused a distant murmur to run under the foliage. Lugubrious and mysterious voices seemed to spring out of the unseen torrent below, climbing toward us and filling the air with threatening words in an unknown language. I was cool and did not fear the thieves. I had seen more than seven together on other occasions, yet I could not suppress a thrill born of the occult atmosphere I myself had created. I was not alone in this. The seven robbers looked petrified, some standing in one line against a rock behind my son, and others zip were down on the path, an awe-struck group which tempted my photographic inclinations. But the hour was not ripe for snapshots. Then one of the pippers cautiously moved toward me and from a little distance uttered words of peace, "Do not be angry, old mother. Here are your 2 rupees. Do not weep. Do not curse us anymore. We only want to go peacefully back to our village." So I allowed my anger and my despair to be cooled, and I took the 2 coins with the air of one who recovers a unique treasure. My young companion had rejoined me. The thieves reverently requested his blessing, which he gave them, adding some good wishes. We then parted. There was no fear that the same band would retrace its steps to rob us. But this new adventure was a warning, not to be overlooked, to leave that specially dangerous area as soon as possible. That night we made a prolonged march in the forest, which seemed still alive with the phantoms of the deities I had summoned. A slow rain, mixed with half-melted snow, began to fall, and a melancholy waning moon rose late amongst the clouds. About 2 o'clock in the morning we came to a place near the river where there was a small level clearing. We were too tired to proceed farther, and discussed the question of how to camp there. Would we dare to pitch our miserable tent, or did prudence command that we should sleep unsheltered on the wet moss, hidden under the trees? Supper was, once more, not to be thought of, although we had neither eaten nor drunk since early morning, nearly 24 hours before. No dry fuel could be found to boil our Tibetan tea, and the dim light was not sufficient to find a place amongst the rocks where we could safely fetch water from the foaming torrent. I thought we could at least give ourselves the comfort of a shelter. It was very doubtful that anybody would be travelling at night in that bad weather. We therefore pitched the small tent, and lay down in our wet damp clothes and muddy boots on the damp ground. The moon, which appeared and disappeared between the clouds, cast fantastic moving shadows of branches and rocks on the white cloth above our heads. The river talked loudly with the many voices of a crowd. Invisible beings seemed to surround us. I was thinking of those I had invoked and, after all, I did not altogether disbelieve in that mysterious world that is so near to those who have lived long in the wilds. My heavy head resting on a small bag of sampa, I smiled to unknown friends, and departed for dreamland. It was not the first time, in the course of my peregrinations in Tibet, that sham magic and robbers combined in the same adventure. I may perhaps be allowed to relate here a rather amusing incident which happened in the desert of grass some 18 months before my meeting with the Pippa's brigands. I had lingered that day far behind my men to collect plants which I meant to send to the Botanical Society of France. It was the rainy season. The grassy desert had become a sea of mud. Under a dull sky, low clouds rolled heavily, hiding the summits, filling the valleys, and wrapping the steppes in a greyish, melancholy shroud. I did not recognize the luminous solitudes, the scenes of so many of my joyful rides some years before, and I should easily have been overpowered by the depressing influence of that ruin of dampness, rain, and fog across which we had wandered, shivering and feverish, for weeks, had I not had many reasons to prevent me from giving way to lassitude and discouragement. My present party numbered 7, including myself. The 6 were Yongnan, 3 servants, and a Chinese Musselman soldier, going back to his country with his Tibetan wife and their little boy, whom I do not reckon in the number. Yongdan and the woman had remained with me, helping me to gather the plants, and the other men were far ahead of us. The weather had now cleared. One could see, between the clouds, the sun almost setting. It was time to proceed to the camp, so we set out, riding slowly in full enjoyment of the peaceful evening. We had left the plain, and having turned the spur of a range, entered a narrow valley, when I saw on my left three men carrying guns slung over their shoulders, who silently disappeared in a recess of the mountains. Who they were was clear enough. Tibetan travelers, in that country, never failed to salute one another with the customary greeting, Ogyal, Ogyor, then they habitually exchange questions about the country whence they came and toward which they go. The silence of these men looked very suspicious, not to mention the fact that they hid themselves, instead of walking along the trail. I went my way, pretending to pay no attention to them, but feeling under my dress to see if my revolver was handy. I whispered to the woman who rode near me, "Ah, did you see them?" "Yes," she answered. "They are robbers. Perhaps they are the scouts of a gang." I looked at a flower that grew on a rock, as if deeply interested in it, and pointing it out to Yongdan, I called him to me. To show any sign of agitation which the brigands, who were perhaps watching us, might interpret as fear, would endanger our lives. The members of the Special Order of Lamas, whose dress I wore, are believed to be fearless and to possess occult powers, and this was our best safeguard. This means, you have undergone hardship, and the answer is, Lags, Marka, Kyalaglail, I have suffered no hardship but you have had a hard time. Have you seen the men in the ravine? I asked my young companion. No. Three men carrying guns, are thieves, no doubt. The woman has seen them. Have your revolver, Adi. As soon as we reach the turning of the trail, and are out of sight, we will ride on fast. We must reach the camp quickly and inform the servants. As I had spoken in English, I did not fear being overheard. We had good beasts, and proceeded quickly. But what was this? We heard a shot in the direction of our people. We rode faster and soon discovered our four tents pitched in the high grass near a stream. Have you seen three men on your road? I immediately asked the servants who came to hold our horses. No, nobody had seen any human being for the last 10 days. I heard a shot. They all hung their heads. I have killed a hare, confessed the soldier. We have no more meat, and my wife feels weak. I always strictly forbid my servants to hunt, but the soldier was not my servant. I dropped the subject. This woman and I have seen three armed men who appeared to hide from us, I said. We must take special precautions tonight for the safety of the camp. It may be that these three have companions in the vicinity. There they are, exclaimed my head servant, Zering, pointing out two men who stood on the crest of the hill above the camp. I looked at them with my glasses. They were the very men that we had seen on our way. Where was the third one? Had he been dispatched to call still other ruffians in order to attack us? Or the two remained watching us? Let us take no more notice of them, I said. We will devise a plan while drinking tea. Put the guns and revolvers in such places that they may be seen by the robbers, if there are any besides these who. It is good to let them know that we are able to defend ourselves. The tea was ready. One of the servants dipped a ladle into the cauldron and threw a few drops of the liquid toward the six quarters, including Zenith and Nadia, shouting, "Drink tea, O gods!" Then our bowls were filled, and, seated around the fire, we began to discuss the situation. The servants suggested that they might climb the neighboring hills and from there try to discover if any gang was in the vicinity. I did not like this idea. The robbers might arrive while they were roaming far from the camp, taking that opportunity to steal some beasts or other things. Yongdan and I alone would have a hard time to defend our belongings, even if the three men whom we had seen, and who had good guns, were the only ones to attack us. "I know a better way," said the soldier. "Let night come, and when darkness hides us, I and two of the men will ambush ourselves separately outside the camp at three different points. Another will remain here as watchman, and he will, according to the Chinese custom, beat a drum or make some such noise all night. The robbers will think that we are all in our tent, and if they appear, one or another of those who are hidden outside the camp will see them and shoot at them when they are between him and the tents. They will thus be surprised and fired upon from behind and in front at the same time. This appeared to be the best plan for a small party like ours, and I decided to follow it. We tied the beasts as fast as we could, for when they do not dare to fight openly, Tibetan brigands fire volleys at short range to frighten the animals. If some of these break their cords and escape, they chase them away and seldom miss capturing a few. Yongdan insisted on erecting a barricade with the bags and boxes containing our provisions. He meant it, of course, as a shelter for us, but, as distinguished illiterators as my adopted son may be, his knowledge does not extend to the art of war. As it was built, it appeared to me that we should rather protect the barricade with our bodies than be protected by it. But I am myself far from being an expert in these matters, and no great general happened to be there to enlighten us. Seldom have I spent such a delightful night as that one, when at each minute we expected an attack. But it was hot, this prospect which lent charm to my vigil. Seated at the entrance of his tent, a bowl of tea near him, Zring sang ballads of the land of calm, thousands of years old. He marked the cadence by striking with a small rod on a Tibetan cauldron in which we boiled tea or soup over our campfire. The songs extolled the high deeds of rustic knights and the primeval forests in which arise shining peaks clad with eternal snows. Robbers these heroes are, like those whose presence in our neighborhood compelled us to keep a watch, like the watchman himself, who, I was aware, had played his part in more than one hot encounter, like the three others who are now acting as sentinels, like everyone in that land of primitive braves who know of no field in which to show their prowess other than the trails followed by rich caravans. Zring had a fine voice. His accents were now heroic, now mystic. The songs told not only of warriors, but of merciful goddesses and holy lamas. Some of the stanzas finished with ardent aspirations toward the spiritual awakening that puts an end to fear and all sorrow. The vulgar cauldron itself had risen to the level of that poetry, its metal sounded solemn as a bell. Zring was indefatigable. He went on with his bewitching recital until dawn. The sentinels came back benumbed by their prolonged stay on the damp grass, and ran to revive the fire and make tea. Zring's song had ceased, and the harmonious cauldron, fallen back to its utilitarian role, stood already filled with water, among the flames. As for Yongdan, he was fast asleep, month his head resting against his barricade. The robbers had not dared to attack us, but they had spent the night near our camp. As we were finishing eating our breakfast, the three men appeared, each one leading a horse. My boys leapt to their feet and ran to them. "Who are you?" they asked. "We saw you yesterday. What are you doing here?"
"We are hunters," answered the newcomers.
"Indeed. That is good luck for us. We have no meat left. We will buy some game from you." The self-styled hunters looked embarrassed. "We have not yet killed anything," they said. "My servants did not need to hear more."
"Do you know," asked Zring of the three Tibetans, "who is the noble, reverend lady who travels with such a beautiful tent and wears a toga, kind of vest worn by lamas, of golden brocade? Would she be the filing Jetsun Ma who lived in Jakiendo?"
"We have heard about her."
"Yes, she is.
And you understand that she does not fear robbers any more than wild beasts or any other thing. One who stole the least of her belongings would immediately be discovered and caught. In that case, she has only to look in a bowl full of water, and at once she sees in it the likeness of the thief, together with the stolen articles and the place where both are to be found."
"So it is really true," said the men.
"All the Dokpas say white foreigners have this power."
"Nothing is more certain," confirmed my head servant.
Zring was well acquainted with the story which was repeated among the cowmen, and he had cleverly taken advantage of it to frighten the robbers and to dissuade them from going to bring their friends to rob us a few days later. About 10 days after that incident, we escaped for the night in front of an encampment of Dokpas.
I retired to TDF tent before night had fallen, and I heard many visitors in the camp. They were bringing presents of milk and butter, and Yongdan told them that the Lama lady had shut herself up for religious meditation and could not be disturbed, but that she would see them the following morning. Then some whispering took place, and a servant having called the Dokpas to drink tea near the kitchen fire, they all moved away and I heard no more of what was said. At dawn Yongdan asked permission to enter my tent. "I must," he said, "inform you, before the Dokpas call again, about the request they made yesterday. They say that some of their horses have been stolen, they do not know by whom, and they wish you to look in a bowl of water in order to describe to them the thieves and the place where they are keeping the stolen animals." "What did you tell them?" I asked. "I think," answered Yongdan, "that maybe these men have bad intentions. Perhaps they have not suffered any loss and they only wish to know if what is said about that bowl of water and the magic power of the Utk foreigner is really true or not. Who knows whether they have not an eye on our line Chinese mules and would not be delighted to steal them if they were convinced that you could not trace the thieves, especially if the robbery happened at a few days' march from their own encampment, at a place where the tribe to which the brigands belong could not be located. If you tell them that you have seen their horses, and that none have been stolen, they will be convinced that you have not been able to detect their lie, and that, therefore, as you are powerless in magic, they may loot us with impunity." I accordingly explained to them that you could indeed see all that they want to know in a bowl of water, but that the water needed is somewhat different from the ordinary water just drawn from the stream. This water must be prepared by ceremonies and the recitation of a ritual that lasts for 3 days. They understood this at once. Idotheri said that it was doubtful if you would stay here 3 days, because you were called to Amdo for an important meeting with the Great Lama. Also, as I know how much they shrink from the idea of killing in cold blood a man who has only stolen property, I added that as soon as you had discovered the thieves you would hand them over to the Chinese magistrate to be put to death. It would be, I said, in the power of no one to spare their lives. The Towo, wrathful deity, by whose power this natatory rite is performed would claim them as victims and, if they were not sacrificed, he would turn his anger against the who had requested the rite to be performed, and he would take their lives instead. On hearing this, they all became terrified. They declared that they feared to irritate the Totu, and preferred to look after their horses in their own way, trying to get a good compensation from the thieves. I smiled at his ruse, and when the Dokpas came with some more presents, I repeated to them the very things Yongdan had told them the day before, so that they definitely gave up all idea of requesting the celebration of the two tragic rites. The head servant, Zering, had travelled in his early youth as far as to Chienlu, and had been in the service of foreigners. As a result of these associations he had acquired a skepticism which he liked to display before his more credulous companions. During the next few days, he did not cease making the incident a subject of his jokes, and laughing at the simpletons who had been so easily fooled. By that time we had reached the shore of the large blue lake, the most holy coconut, worshipped by thousands of Tibetans and Mongolians. The rains were over, I could again see that wonderful inland sea, bathed in bright sunshine, and its rocky islands, the largest of which has been for centuries the dwelling of a few anchorites. Once when I was coming back to the camp after having bathed in the lake, I saw Tzering leaving Yongdan's tent and hastily putting something in his breast pocket. He looked a little agitated and proceeded quickly toward the kitchen place without noticing me. The same evening Yongdan told me that, having been called away on some business while counting money, he had left his purse on a box in his tent and had forgotten about it. When he returned, 3 rupees were missing. I did not tell him about Tzering. I only scolded him for his carelessness, and the thing ended there. 3 days later I arranged on my camp table a few blades of grass and some rice. I lighted several incense sticks, and in the middle I placed a bowl full of water. Then I waited until I knew that the servants were in their tent, undressed and edged down, if not yet asleep. At that time, according to their custom, all their most precious belongings, and especially their money, would be hidden beneath whatever they used as a pillow. For a while I rang the small bell and beat the tambourine used by lamas in their religious ceremonies. Then I called Zering. "Zering," I said with a stern voice, when he appeared, "3 rupees are missing from Lama Yongden's purse. I have seen them under your head when you were lying down. Go and fetch them." The skeptic dropped his manner of sneering incredulity. He turned pale, his teeth were chattering. He bowed down 3 times at my feet and without a word went to the servant's tent and brought back the money. "Jetsun Kusho Rinpoche," he asked, trembling, "will the Towo kill me?" "No," I answered, gravely. "I shall do what is needed to spare your life." He bowed down again and went away. Then, alone in my small tent, open to the silent desert and the bright starry sky, I took once more the Lamaist bell and the drum of mystic rites and, led by their archaic music, I meditated on the strength of ancestral faiths in the human mind and on the deep and mysterious side of the fast that had just been enacted. In Tibet, adventures with robbers have always a certain picturesqueness, of the kind, however, that one does not want in too large a quantity, so that I was glad to meet no more ruffians on my way during the days that followed my dramatic performance in their forest. We were now nearing Tongyuk, where Azong has been cunningly placed at the intersection of 2 roads for the examination of travelers proceeding to Lhasa. Like many things in Tibet, this cleverness is a little childish, and a pedestrian can dodge it without making extraordinary efforts. From Tongyuk one can reach Jayamda, the capital of the Kongpa province, by a much more direct track than that which winds far to the south touching the Brahmaputra. I have been told that it crosses uninhabited regions, and for that reason travelers prefer the long bend on the south. Time has but little value in the east, and the safety and convenience of a road are the main concern of all Tibetan travelers. It is also possible to travel northwards from Tongyuk toward the grassy solitudes. Although only a few of them are shown on the maps, Tibet is crossed by a large number of tracks, some easy, some rough, and, save in exceptional circumstances, the future explorers of the unsurveyed regions need not fear the necessity of cutting their way with axes through impassable jungles. What I say applies, of course, only to people who can travel according to the native fashion, as I have done on all my journeys. If one needs large tents, tables, chairs, tinned Western food, an oven to bake the bread, and a gramophone which some explorers carried in their luggage, then perhaps he will get into trouble with the rustic Tibetan paths, and also, perhaps, with the sturdy hillmen who have made them. The toll bridge of Tongyuk spans a narrow but rather deep mountain stream, which throws itself into the river Tongyuk a little farther on. It is cleared by a gate, and nearby is the house of the bridge keeper. When we knocked at the gate, the latter set it just ajar to look at us. Without leaving him the time to put any question, we asked, hurriedly, as if in great anxiety, "Are our friends there?" "Which friends?" inquired the man. "That large party of Sera and Ipung monks. They left this morning." "What a pity," we both lamented. The keeper bade open the door a little more. We took immediate advantage of this to step in, continuing the while to make the poor fellow giddy with our questions. We wished to know if the trippers had not left a message for us, and also a bag containing some dried meal which belonged to us. Yongden eyed the Tibetan in a suspicious way, and the latter endeavored to convince him that no one of the party had handed him anything, protesting that he was too honest to keep the property of a lama. My companion, intent upon the question of the dried meat, seemed to have forgotten everything else, especially the fact that travelers had to apply at the Zong to get permission to proceed. His pretense was played in a masterly fashion. Yet I thought that the keeper, although he looked bewildered, might still bear his duty in mind and remind us of the permission we had to secure before proceeding farther. I asked in a whining voice, "Has the Ponpo given some solra, alms to our friends?" "I do not know," was the answer. "Well," I replied, "I shall try to get some. My son, the lama, has hurt his foot. We have fallen back and have no food left, now that this bag of dried meat is not here. About the bag I will know through Owo, said Yongnan, sternly, my mo's never fail to be true.
Yes, yes, the suspected innocent gladly agreed, Wojiab, Lama. You can see the Ponpa afterwards.
I am going at once, I declared. Maybe he will be kind to me.
This was a matter of indifference to the keeper.